Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to the Frontier Beyond Fear radio program. I am your host, Susan Laris and Danz, and today we have a very interesting guest on the show. Her name is Christine Wuschke, and Christine is a very talented yoga and meditation teacher with over 15 years' experience. She works up in Canada, but she also holds retreats outside of Canada and has one coming up in Hawaii, which she'll talk about. Christine and I today are going to talk about a gentle introduction to yoga because, quite honestly, I am a yoga novice. And we're also going to talk about meditation, conscious parenting, any number of things, just a chat between friends. And Christine and I met quite some time ago online and in a very synchronistic way. And then over the years, both of us have walked spiritual paths that are ever evolving and growing. Now, before I bring Christine on, I will let you know the call-in number for the show. We do welcome questions if you would like to call in. That number is 1-310-807-5104. And there is also a chat room active for the show right now, and you can see the chat just by listening to the show and looking at it. But if you actually want to participate in the chat, you need to have a Blog Talk Radio login, which is very simple to obtain, and then you can actually interact with us. And I will be conveying questions from the chat today and comments as well. Also, if you're hearing a little bit of audio issues, I would welcome some input from the chat just to see how the sound quality is out there. This is a real informal show. We try to make it informal, and but we try to keep the audio quality as well as upgraded as possible. So if you could let us know if you're having any difficulty hearing us, I would really appreciate you letting us know that in the chat. So thank you for that. So now I'd like to welcome Christine. Christine, I'm so happy to have you here today.
Hi, Susan. Nice to be here.
Well, I'll tell you, Christine, I'm so happy that we have an opportunity to talk on this show because I've heard you in other venues and you have some absolutely beautiful things to share about your own experiences of expanded consciousness and how you integrate that into your life. So maybe one of the things you can do to start us off is why don't you tell us a little bit about your own path and how you got into yoga and how you got into meditation and how the mysteries of expanded consciousness have grown for you and impacted your life.
Well, I actually started pretty young. I was 16 years old, and I had a close aunt die of lung cancer, and it was sort of the first loss. Well, not the first, but it was a pretty impacting loss for me, and sort of made me reach for something. And she had been taking a program during her cancer treatment, which was it was essentially a meditation course, but it was all about consciousness and awareness and inner peace. And that woman spoke at my aunt's funeral, and so I just heard her speak and felt this very deep resonance, and ended up taking private lessons with her shortly after. So it all started when I was 16, sort of the journey for me began then. And she was also a yoga teacher, but I was more drawn to the meditation and yoga philosophy aspect. So I really jumped in with both feet at that point, and right out of high school decided to be a yoga teacher.
Wow.
So, yeah, it definitely had an impact on me at a young age. So
now, I think if you think back to when you first started and also what you advise your students now, I think one of the challenges that people face when they first start, and maybe even over time, is clearing the mind. How do you help your students, and how did you yourself, when you first started, get to that point where you felt you were able to clear your mind so that you could effectively meditate or participate in yoga in a real effective way?
Yeah, it was definitely a journey for me in that. And initially, it was I used a mantra meditation, and I would repeat the mantra to still the mind. And I tried that for years and years and years. And it actually didn't work all that well for me. Like, I would have moments of the mind chatter sort of diminishing, but I would never really have a sense of, like, a quiet mind. And after, I don't know, like, a good 10 years of trying that, I kind of gave up on it. And it was around that point where I discovered self-inquiry, which was to instead of sort of trying to still the mind, is sort of to go into the chatter and to really look into it. And that started to work for me a little bit better. And then I found satsang and started sort of sitting with spiritual teachers. And things kind of shifted around at that point where it became more of just an allowing the chatter to be there instead of trying to make it go away and resist it and fight with it. There, I would just allow it to be there. And that seemed to be the thing that did work for me, was to just, you know, stop in the moment and let everything be as it is and let the thoughts be there, and then drop a little bit further into the body and to just feel the sensations in the body. That seemed to be the thing that would actually be a little bit more effective. So it's interesting because when my students come to me, the very first yoga class they've ever done, and I don't really recommend the mantra practice anymore. I even have a CD out with it on there and everything, but it's and it can work. So it's not to say that it doesn't work, but I just, in my experience, it didn't work all that well for me. So now what I recommend is more for even the beginning students is to go more with the what I call the allowing practice. So you just stop in the moment and let everything be as it is. And it's something that's simple, and you can even do it when you're driving, and, you know, you don't have to necessarily turn everything off to do it. So
I like that, because it seems like sometimes we lose patience with ourselves, you know, and we need what I let, you know, you are the second teacher that I've heard this from recently, because this is something that I'm asking just from my own heart too. When I do this show, I ask the questions that I want to know about too, representing, I know, a lot of people in the audience. Well, you know, you have to understand my path didn't start out with yoga and meditation and all of that. And even now, I'm just learning how to integrate some of that into my path. And you'll find that I'm a yoga novice, which we will talk about in a minute. But the thing that I like about what you're saying is we do tend sometimes to obsess about, you know, oh, I've got to clear my mind, or, you know, depending on what instructions you have heard or what book you've read. And I love how you just allow it to be, and it just naturally happens. It's kind of like if you're trying to go to sleep and you obsess about going to sleep, then you don't go to sleep.
Whereas you can't even make yourself go to sleep, as the sleep happens on its own. So it's very much like that in my experience. I mean, for years I had read all the books on spirituality and sort of had this mental picture of what it was like to be a spiritual person. And so I had sort of formulated this mold that, okay, this is how spiritual person is, and this is how they act, and this is how they should be. And so I try to sort of squeeze myself into this mold and be like that. And at some point, that all just kind of fell away. The experiences started to happen naturally, just like I was saying about falling asleep. So the deep states of meditation started to just happen. And then the ideas about it started to kind of fall away, and the fight with it, because there was sort of this fight. It's like, oh, the mind is supposed to be quiet, and I'm supposed to be non-reactive and nice all the time, and all these things. And so when something would come up, I fight with it. Whereas now if something comes up, I allow it, and what I found is that it gives it space. So the allowing gives it some room to organically unravel, and it's just such a natural process instead of a forced process. I don't think there's one thing that works for everyone, but that seems to be the thing that worked for me, was this allowing. I call it the welcoming meditation. So you just welcome everything. You let everything in instead of trying to shape things and mold things and navigate, just allow things to be as they are.
Now, what about breathing, Christine? I know certainly within yoga and meditation both, that's a very key part. As someone who, if you have people come to you who are new to this and want to learn how to control their breath, what do you recommend in that domain?
Well, at this point, and I certainly incorporate this into my yoga classes, I find it's actually such a beautiful practice, is to just sit and experience the breath as if, so if I'm teaching a class, what I would walk my students through is I would say something along the lines of, pretend that you are dropping onto an alien planet, like you're a space explorer. And you're dropping onto an alien planet. You have absolutely no idea what anything is. You're just exploring. So you wouldn't have a judgment on the terrain because you don't know what anything is. You're just curious. And so what I walk them through is to drop awareness into the body in that way. So be in the body as if for the first time. And then experience the breath as if for the first time. So if in this moment it was the first time you were ever noticing this thing we call breathing, you can actually really dive into it. And there's a quality of nourishment that's sort of always there in the breath. It's always present, whether we're aware of it or not. And the breath has this deep nourishing quality to it. So I find this to be a really simple thing that people can use, you know, in cases where maybe there's a lot of stress, or, you know, even when you're driving, is to just drop into the breath and experience it as if experiencing it for the first time, and then to really feel it, to feel the experience of breathing. And you may pick up on the quality of nourishment and you may not right away, but it's definitely there, and it just serves as such a great calming, and it's just very rich to just be with the breath in that way. So that's usually the way that I, in yoga we call the breath practice pranayama. So that's sort of the way that I approach it now, is more from a feeling level, like to experiencing the breath and feeling the breath, rather than trying to control it through various techniques, which have their value too. It just doesn't seem to be the thing that I'm working with at this time. But
now, when you do a retreat, Christine, I know you get people at various levels, and certainly I don't know how your classes are structured. Maybe you can talk about that a little bit. How do you teach to a diverse group? You know, some people who may be more advanced in their practice, and or people who are just starting out, because I know you have a retreat coming up and you've done them in the past. How do you work with a diverse group? I'm just curious and how you do that.
I guess I try to meet every moment fresh. That's sort of my approach to life. So I would meet the people where they are. Typically, if I'm teaching a yoga class of people who've never, ever, ever done yoga before, I'll approach it from the level of just stretching the muscles first, so that people can really experience the body in a really, a loving and honoring way, because what I find is that people don't often just people who have, like, you know, 9-to-5 jobs and 4 kids and they're very busy, there's not often a lot of time in their week where they can just be with themselves and give the body a little bit of attention. So I usually approach it from that aspect because I find that something everybody can relate to is that the body probably is in need of a bit of attention. And so we just go into some really gentle stretching and awareness on the breath. And what I call the allowing practice. So we do all of that together. So we're stretching and we're allowing and we're breathing and aware of the muscles that are being stretched. And I find that it's actually something that anybody can do. It's you know, to lay on the floor and bring your knees to your chest and stretch your back. It's a movement. Pretty much any body can do that. And then you can start to, you know, yoga is one of those things that expands on itself. So once you start to stretch, you start to really realize how much you need it. And then you start to crave it. You know, after a few weeks, it's like, wow, I think the body really needs a good stretch. So, yeah, it's just sort of more, I would say the diversity thing would be more, I approach it from the stretching perspective. So it's like a class of stretching the muscles and honoring the body. A lot of times I'll say that we're giving ourselves an inner spa treatment. So just to bring some nourishment and attention into the body, you know, it's something we don't often have a lot of time for, excuse me. So it can be really beneficial.
I think there's this perception sometimes that to do yoga, and I have certainly had this, I will share with you honestly, Christine, that to do yoga, you have to be really flexible. You know,
right.
I was one of these people who, you know, it's not even, I mean, I'm not that old now, but, you know, as I've gotten older, I'm probably less flexible. But even when I was younger, you know, I was one of these people who was not very athletic and kind of stayed away from gymnastics and that kind of thing. And so I think probably a lot of us have to get over this perception that we have to be this ultra limber person to do yoga, that it really can meet you where you are and it will actually make you more limber, right? I mean, that's the whole idea, is it feeds itself.
Well, I was trained in Iyengar yoga, which is actually often nicknamed furniture yoga because we use so many props. And that's one of the basic principles of Iyengar yoga, is to let the pose meet your body where it is, instead of trying to strain to shape your body into a position that it just can't naturally do yet. So then we use the props. So every pose has lots of modifications. There's sort of a spectrum. There's a, you know, there's a range in what a typical body can do. So, yeah, the approach is definitely to meet your body where it is and start from there. And
yeah, I appreciate that.
Yeah, it's so much. What I find is that because the approach is so gentle, that the body can actually open, like, in a sense, you almost become more, as a side effect, you become more flexible than to try to force yourself to be flexible, because there isn't that huge resistance there. So if you're all propped up with blankets and you can totally relax into the stretch, there's often a pretty deep openness that happens, and the muscles relax into the stretch instead of trying to kind of, you know, push it and force it, which sometimes, you know, you'll be sore the next day. And so I find that approach, like the restorative yoga and the just the really gentle stretching with props, the kind that can sort of meet anybody. And the really fit and flexible people are probably better geared to like a power yoga class where they're, you know, anybody's welcome to come to any class, but it's like the power yoga classes are more those ones where you sort of have to be flexible to start with, because the poses are pretty challenging. So once you've been doing yoga for a few years, then you can take one of those classes and it'll probably be easy for you. But in the beginning, they can be really, really challenging. So that's why I like this approach, to start from where you're at and let that sort of openness and flexibility happen naturally and gradually, and then it's the defenses of the body kind of drop on their own. So it's just a very kind of honoring and gentle approach.
I was going to say, I wonder if part of our perception sometimes is due to yoga being everywhere now at all the athletic clubs. It's become another almost like an aerobics class kind of thing. And some of those classes, you know, they have very strict standards, and they could be more demanding and not quite as gentle. And you know, maybe you can talk about, and I do see you guys in the chat room. I'm going to convey some questions from the chat in a minute, but maybe you can talk a little bit about how the spiritual approach to yoga, which is the approach you take, compares to what, not to say all athletic clubs are not offering it some kind of spiritual approach, but, you know, the more athletic version that seems mm-hmm. to be out there a lot these days.
Yeah. Yeah, I think there's definitely some approaches out there that are just strictly fitness-based only. They're coming more from that angle of, and maybe even the angle of health and wellness, but it's not so much the full, the spiritual element of yoga is a huge aspect of yoga, but I think some people are intimidated by it because it's something that they don't understand, especially in the West. You know, it hasn't been around for that long. So the sort of deeply spiritual aspect of yoga can be, I think, for some people a little bit intimidating and sort of foreign. And the Eastern philosophies can be a little bit different. So in that sense, I think sometimes the fitness aspects can be good for some people to start there because it's a little bit more of a gradual introduction. And then if they're interested in the more meditative and spiritual aspects, then, you know, they'll probably be able to find one of those classes out there somewhere. There seems to be quite a few different approaches out there right now. There's lots of different ways to approach yoga. So there's something for everybody.
Uh-huh. Well, I have a question from the chat room, mentioning mm-hmm. everybody out there. This is from Kevin in the chat room.
Okay.
Would you describe meditation as the yoga of awareness or of attention?
Well, yoga is the word. The word yoga means union. So I would say that yes to the first one. I'm not sure about the second one. The meditation as the yoga of awareness, I would say yes, because the sort of objective, for lack of a better word, is to experience that union or that oneness with everything. So the where the awareness is one with all, which is what the word yoga means. So, and that would probably, that's sort of my approach, but I would word it differently for different people. So that's sort of like the goal, though.
Now, perhaps Kevin can clarify what he means by of attention.
Maybe having attention undivided.
Or focus, perhaps.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, when you talk about expanded consciousness, I will tell you this show has a pretty diverse audience. Not mm-hmm. everybody is familiar with the idea of expanded consciousness. And one of the things I'm finding on this show, and just in general, life in general, is that people may be experiencing this in their own way without labeling it the same way, even you know, from very diverse spiritual paths. And so maybe you can talk a little bit about your own experience of the universe. It's a big question. You couldn't get bigger than that. Your experience of the universe. You know, you've talked, well, the reason I'm asking this is because you have spoken of this on your website. I mean, you've talked about experiencing the void. That's one of the things I've heard you talk about, and, you know, the mystery. And, you know, maybe you can tell us, you know, what does that really mean to you? Maybe you can even give us an example if you feel comfortable doing that, just to help people understand, you know, what is the goal here? You know, where, I mean, maybe there is no goal. It's just now. I mean, a lot of people will say
that. I used
that.
To think there was a goal. But now that whole thing is a lot more hazy. Definitely when I was young and starting out, so I was probably 18 years old, and I was diving right into these books like the Yoga Sutras and the Upanishads, and there would be these, you know, passages about samadhi and enlightenment and all of these things. And I sort of, like I shared with you earlier, had formulated this mental picture of what all of that was. And at the time, a lot of it was just theory. So it was like, okay, well, someday I'll get to experience this, you know, bliss and liberation and all of this stuff. And it was all very conceptual for me at the time. When I was 28 years old, I was meditating and I had a spontaneous, what they call kundalini eruption, which was I had the realization that I'm not what I thought I was. And the kundalini energy went through the top of my head and there was the experience of expanded consciousness. So that was probably the first moment where, well, actually not the first. I had this experience also when I was six, but I didn't know what it was then. So this would have been the second time where I had the realization or insight that what I am is actually consciousness and not a person. And it was an experience that sort of lasted for about 2 weeks. So I was in a very sort of disoriented space for quite a while because the change was pretty different in thinking that I was Christine to realizing that I'm actually consciousness. But the experience did fade, and then I went through a sort of a process of what I would call inner cleansing. So a lot of stuff started kind of coming up for attention. And my initial reaction to all these things was to resist them, you know, because of my spiritual training. You have to be positive all the time, and you can't be angry. And all this anger was coming up, so I didn't really know what to do. Yeah, I didn't know what to do with it all. So I was still at that time essentially trying to push myself into the spiritual mold and trying to be a certain way. And I didn't really have the experience of knowing what to do with all these emotions and all these experiences that were coming up. And at some point, it took years, but at some point there was, I don't know if it was an inner insight or something a teacher had said, but at some point it was like, no, you need to walk into the anger, you need to walk into the sorrow and actually let it be there and give it 100% permission. So it was a little bit counterintuitive for me at the time because my impulse was always to run from these experiences of the so-called negative. So at some point, I just tried it. So I just would completely allow sorrow and let it be 100% there. And what happened was It did create a space for it. So it created some room so that the sorrow could unravel on its own. And after, you know, years of this process, it just came to the point where it wasn't a big deal. So it wasn't something to be so afraid of. So I actually sort of call it walking through the fire, that I had always sort of been running from it or I would have an aversion to it. And actually, this kind of leads me into my parenting thing. So if I can go into that now,
yeah,
sort of relate.
Feel free, feel free.
Because my son was one of the hugest teachers for me in this exact thing because one of my biggest aversions or biggest fears was that I'm a bad mom, that I'm a bad mother. And so what I came to notice over time was that there was a behavior that stemmed out of that aversion, that stemmed out of that fear. And it was unconscious to me at the time, but what I would do is I would put pressure on my son to be a good kid. Everywhere we went, he had to be a good kid. And what I didn't realize that what I was doing was I was projecting my fear, my aversion, onto him and trying to shape him into what I thought he should be. And so through this work, there came a point in time where that was up to, you know, walk through that fire of I'm a bad mom. And I sat with that one and gave it 100% permission. Okay, I'm just going to feel this bad momness. And what happened was over time, the whole thing unraveled and fell apart. And then I realized the behavior. I sort of saw what I was doing. And so that fell away on its own, that pressure that I had been putting on him. And what I noticed was the change in my relationship with him. So there was a shift in the way, because I didn't feel this need for him to be a certain way, it's like he felt that inner permission to relax into just who he is. And he sort of came into his naturalness, and I relaxed into the relationship a lot more. So it's really, really shifted my approach to parenting to have you know, essentially cleaned out that that aversion to being a bad mom. So it's more of an acceptance that, you know, some days I'm a good mom and some days I'm a bad mom, but it's not such a, this, it's not a looming fear that sort of, you know, I feel like I have to run from it kind of thing.
Well, I think with parenting, there are often so many expectations that we place on ourselves. You know, we feel that it's the most important thing we're doing. And you know, I really, you know, I have to say I had a somewhat similar experience. And lately, I've been actually pondering this in the last week because in the news, at least in the U.S., in the news, there's been a lot about tiger moms in the news where a tiger mom, there's this woman who wrote a book on being a tiger mom, is very authoritarian and very unaccepting, basically. Like this tiger mom actually rejected a birthday card that her daughter gave to her because it wasn't good enough and things like that. And, you know, of course, that was pushing my buttons, and I had to try to not let it do that. But, you know, it did help me to reflect upon, you know, I think that when I was starting out as a mom too, there's a tendency to say no, no, you know, to try to mold that behavior, especially if you have a very active child, you know, and and it's not only their behavior, it is so, I really like how you realize that it's a lot about you, not about them.
Right.
That, you know, maybe some of it is fear of judgment, you know, you'll be judged as a bad parent. And, you know, my own journey is really similar in that once I mean, I am the antithesis of the tiger mom, is that, you know, I involve my child in decisions and, you know, that really, you know, there's some guidance, but, you know, I just do no longer believe in authoritarian parenting approaches because I really, they certainly don't work for me. I mean, I allow people to do what they feel is right for them, but for me, it doesn't work. And now I'm seeing the fruits of that where, you know, I have a very well-balanced child, you know, get compliments all the time. And, you know, and I have released that feeling of control. And really do allow more because I really did see it as more often it's you being concerned about how both you and your child are going to be perceived and your parenting, which is a false construct that isn't really about what's happening in the real world. So anyway, I really do find that interesting because I had the same experience. Now, we have another question.
Okay.
I don't know. Do you have anything more to say about parenting? I'll let you do that, and then I'll go to the question.
Well, I guess just one more thing came up when you were talking about the sort of the tigress. I had an experience not too long ago where I definitely had the experience of the mother grizzly bear.
Oh boy!
I can't remember actually what happened anymore. It was so long ago, but there was this. This instinct that kind of came up, which was like the, you know, the mother grizzly bear instinct. It was like, don't mess with my kid. and you know, it's like that's, for that too, like to not think that you have to make that go away, because it's like that instinctual parent, it's there for a reason, so, you know, to keep our children safe. So to not, I had to sort of look at that one too. It's like to not have an aversion to the human instinct, which was, I need to protect this child. He's, you know, he's essentially my responsibility until he gets to a certain age. And so it's like I, you know, didn't want to spiritualize that either, but to sort of have it be where allowing the response to come up, which was in this case, the mother grizzly bear response, and to just feel it and sit with it and then act, you know, sort of from a place of not trying to react unconsciously, but to sort of walk through the fire and get to that place of conscious awareness and then act from there, so that it wasn't like I have to extract this mother instinct and make it go away and then act like a spiritual person. It was sort of more the opposite. It was like allow the instinct to be there, which is the protective instinct to keep this child safe, and then but not react unconsciously, but to, I don't know if that's making sense or not, but to sort of let the whole thing unravel and approach the situation from a place of conscious awareness.
Well, you know, this show is one of the main themes is all about fear, and nowhere do fears come up more in parenting than, you know, as a mother. I mean, because of course you have this instinct to keep your child safe and to protect them. And something else I wanted to mention about the whole tiger mom thing is, you know, my experience, this is worthy of a show in itself, I think, at some point.
Absolutely.
But my experience, and this I think is a basic metaphysical phenomenon, is that if you push really hard, if you're pushing, there's going to be a pushback in response, is that there will be this resistance. And it's contradictory in its approach because the very thing that it's trying to eliminate, it creates because it creates more resistance.
Yeah.
And so it does require a very open consciousness. It requires skill to parent without being that authoritarian tigress. It does. I think it's actually easier to just say no all the time. You know, it really is. And it's certainly an instinct that you can fall into really easily. But what's going to happen then as the child gets older is, I believe, there will be more resistance, not less. And it's not really going to accomplish the goal that it's meant to accomplish. And that, you know, we so often don't respect our children. I mean, see, that's another thing that I feel is so important, is having respect for your child and for their opinion, and, you know, not treating them like they don't know anything, because that communicates such a poor self-esteem when you do that.
Yeah, and I think for me that what that comes down to is the ownership aspect is the recognition that I don't own anything. So I don't own my son. He's not mine. And I'm responsible for him and responsible for his safety, but he's his own being. And he's come here for his own karmic whatever. Like, he has his own path that doesn't have anything to do with me. And so to sort of stand back and let him be who he is, I think it gives him that sovereignty, like it gives him that freedom. And like I say about the inner permission, there's sort of a space that you can hold, and the child picks up on it energetically, or they just may pick up on it unconsciously. But if you're sort of bowing to them, bowing to your child, and you're honoring all that they are and honoring their freedom and not sort of, you know, projecting all your stuff onto them, I think it creates a different space. I don't know. This is my experience with my son, but that it also makes me think, when you were talking just then, it also kind of made me think of the meditative approach as well. So when you're saying the thing about the fighting with the child and the pushback, when you were describing that, it reminded me of we were talking earlier about the meditation. And if the meditation is approached that way, like, I'm going to force the mind to be silent, there's like a pushback. There's this fight that happens, which is why the allowing seems to just create a space where things can kind of unravel on their own instead of creating that tension and that fight. So it's interesting that you brought that up, because it made me think, it's the same as the mind.
Well, it's, you know, we do come to similar conclusions, I think. And I really, like, I have to tell you that what you said about your child being an independent soul on a journey, I can't tell you how many times that has comforted me as a parent. And in fact, it actually helps with this, you know, where you're worried about your child all the time, because, you know, not that you, of course, you're still going to have some level of protectiveness and all that, but I think it helps in general in the world to realize that everything that happens in the world has a purpose, and that every soul is on a journey, and we so often forget that with children. How many lives, I mean, I firmly believe in reincarnation, and you can talk about that too, and how many lives have your children had? I mean, essentially, we are not superior to our children. Now, granted, when they're young and learning, I mean, they do look to you for guidance, but they have been here many, many times before, and in some ways, you know, children, when they first come on the earth, are probably more connected to that great mystery because they just came from it, and so they have things to teach us.
Yeah, my son was a real mind opener. When he was little, he would say all. He was very articulate at a very, very young age. So he was, you know, he would talk about all kinds of things that he was seeing and experiencing, and it's like, wow, who are you?
Well, that's cool.
Yeah. So he was definitely a, you know, a huge, you know, he almost essentially threw me into the deep end of the mystery. Because, you know, he was just, especially when he was first born, you know, it's just to be with this this unconditioned mind, this pure being, and he was just, he had so much light. So it was just the being, having the experience of being with a being like that. And of course, it was just, I mean, with anybody who spends any amount of time with a baby, it's like that. But yeah, it's just, it's a very special experience to be with somebody new like that. So he was like my guru when he was little.
Yeah. You know, the other thing that I think about too is that if only, and there are some of these now, if only schools could begin to understand this approach as well, because we have a very old-fashioned model of schooling our children, which really is based on the tiger mom model. And, you know, nowadays in the U.S., there's a lot of talk about how our education system has to catch up with China and all this stuff, and so we have to be even more stringent. And the interesting thing is that if we just allowed more freedom, that would accomplish more in the next generation than anything. And I've actually seen evidence of that. I mean, I know someone with a child who was in a school that was very authoritarian and old-fashioned that really wasn't working, and then ended up being transferred to a charter school, which we jokingly call an indigo school, although it's a formal, it's not even a private school. But at that school, the kids, and this is a high school, they're allowed to dress as they want to dress. Like if they want to, you know, dress in a costume one day, or you know, if they want to paint their hair purple or whatever, it doesn't matter. And there's just a lot more tolerance. And what has happened is this person has blossomed, absolutely blossomed. And that's what would happen with more of our children if we treated them with the respect that they deserve, instead of just constantly controlling, you know, the zero tolerance approach. That's the ultimate in control. And, you know, because we're not trying to create little robots, we're trying to create expressive, creative human beings. That's where,
I've never,
you know,
really had much luck with control in general on any level.
No, I understand.
I've kind of given up on it, actually.
Well, I think that's where we ultimately are led, because we find out it's an illusion, isn't it? I mean, you really don't have it when you think you do.
Yeah.
Especially controlling another person.
That's right. It's not possible. Yeah. I found that as the deep satisfaction started to really steep throughout my being, just through the yoga and the journey that I was on, that the desire for control kind of fell away on its own. It didn't really have a lifespan anymore. There was no reason to control the outcome of events, because the satisfaction that was being experienced inside was more satisfying than, you know, winning the lottery could be, or, you know.
Yeah, I think so
maybe
much.
Changing that person into this or any, there was nothing out there that was going to cut it compared to the states I started experiencing. So the desire for control just kind of petered out.
Yeah, I think so much, you know, this has certainly happened to me where you think something has to be a certain way now, like I need this now, you know, and it hasn't helped that we have books like The Secret out there suggesting, you know, what you want now you will have or whatever, you know, and it's not exactly that way, because what I've seen is when something doesn't exactly come about as the way you expect, it's because it's building something even better, really. I mean, it's part of the journey, and sometimes that includes hardship, but we forget that those challenges, first of all, it's one of the reasons we're here, but if we try to control all of that, sometimes, I mean, it just doesn't work. And also, if we can just surrender to the process and knowing that whatever happens is happening to fulfill your greater good, and also not just your greater good, but all the people that you interact with, because so often we forget that too, that, you know, there are other people in this equation. It's not just you, and that we're all doing this together based on agreement and you know, as souls. That's what I believe in. We are getting some, I'll let you respond to that, and then I am going to involve the chat a little bit, because I didn't mean to ignore what's going on in the chat room. There is a question there. Anyway, you can reflect on that for a second, and then we'll go to the chat room.
Okay.
So we can address that question there.
Which one?
Well, I guess maybe we're done. Maybe we're done with that topic. Actually, let's go to the chat, so because we don't have tons of time left, and I want to make sure they're involved in the conversation. Kevin in the chat room has another question. How do you approach aversion to aversion itself? Are there times when you have to be allowing with fear, anger, or avoidance? And you may have already answered this question,
I think so.
At least partially.
Yeah,
I think you did.
Yeah,
so,
it's sort of like the saying, don't resist the resistance.
right.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, there's also, interestingly enough, you guys must be telepathic, because I was just thinking, believe it or not, before it even showed up, I was thinking, I need to remember to ask Christine about the dolphins. And then what do? You type dolphins in the chat room. Very good. Very good. So we are all connected. Soon we won't even need
Definitely.
A radio show. We'll just do a telepathic interview.
Well, the dolphins are telepathic.
Yeah, I want to hear about this, because there's a fascinating account that I read on your website about a friend getting lost in the water, and that was so interesting to me. Talk to us about the dolphins, and while you're at it, feel free to talk a little bit about your retreat coming up, because
sure.
I do want you to be able to mention that while you're here.
Okay. I had heard about, you know, dolphins are telepathic, but I didn't actually really believe that until this experience happened and continued to happen. So it didn't happen just one time. It happened, you know, pretty much every time I was in the water with them, which was, you know, 8 or 9 times. So it definitely left me with, okay, there's definitely something about these beings. But
yeah.
The first time that I was in the water, I was with a friend, and I'm a very strong swimmer, and he wasn't 100% comfortable in the water. So he said, can you keep an eye on me while we're out here? And because we were quite far out. And, of course, when you're approaching wild dolphins, you can't go up to them. That's just, you know, it's not respectful to the animal. So if you want to have an encounter with a wild dolphin, you have to essentially just float. And if they come to you, they do. And if they don't, they don't. You can't go chase them. So it's against the law for one, but also just, I mean, it's like if you wanted to meet a person, you wouldn't chase them down the street and tug on their jacket.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't work like that. But so we were out there and we just did, you know, you're just sort of snorkeling, and then we came to a place and we could see them off in the distance. So we just stopped and floated. And I had turned over on my back, and I was just sort of meditating on my back in the water, just floating. And at some point, I thought I could hear something, so I rolled over and looked down, and there was a dolphin right under me. And I was just so enamored I was just, wow! Oh, my God! And there was just this feeling of pure love, like I was describing with my son when he was a baby. It's just the same sort of experience of pure love and joy in being with this being, but at some point, I looked up and I couldn't see my friend. And I had the thought, oh, my God, I lost him. What am I going to do?
No.
And as soon as I had that thought, this dolphin came back. And he just went right under me, and he was sort of looking at me, and I got the feeling I'm supposed to follow him. So he swam, and I followed him, and he led me back to my friend. So that was sort of my first experience with, oh, I wonder if he knew, like somehow he picked up on my my fear. But there were several experiences that happened after that where as soon as I would have a thought, a dolphin would respond in some way or another. So the next thing that happened was I was, we had got floated really, really, really far away, and I had sort of looked up and realized just how far out I was away from shore and sort of had a little panic, like, ooh, I sure hope I can make it back there okay. And this dolphin showed up again, and he just started swimming towards shore, and I was like, he's escorting me. And sure enough, he just sort of took me right to, you know, and then he turned and left, and when he turned and left, I looked up, and I was maybe 300 meters from the beach, so I really felt like he picked up on that thought, too. So,
wow.
Yeah, so that, and it just sort of continually happened, so I realized when I'm out there that, you know, I had to, I could really kind of direct thoughts at them and they would essentially respond. So I'm not sure how that works, if they're picking up on your energy or what, but.
So what was your friend's experience?
What did my friend experience?
Yeah, with
well, it was interesting because
he was uncomfortable, right?
He was uncomfortable, and his experience was actually more that he didn't think the dolphin, because essentially, like I say, you have to wait for them to come to you. So he sort of was going through this insecurity of, you know, I'm sure they'll come to Christine, but they won't come to me. And he saw them first. He turned over, and they were right under him. And they swam away with him. And so they essentially took him away, and he sort of felt like they were reassuring him. So his experience was, you know, yes, you are acceptable.
Yeah.
So it was almost like they divided us on purpose. But, yeah.
Didn't they make him feel more comfortable in the water? I thought
mentioned
that.
I wrote about that. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
He's very comfortable in the water now. And myself as well. Like, I am actually quite afraid of swimming in the ocean. But I don't experience that fear when the dolphins are in the bay. So I do feel this sense of calm that comes over them. So when I don't enjoy swimming in the ocean as much when I know they're not around. But when I know they're sort of in the general vicinity, I do feel a lot more comfortable.
Yeah, that's interesting to me because I'll tell you, you know, I'm not a very confident swimmer. I'm kind of like your friend. Actually, I haven't been in the ocean, really. Of course, I haven't really been.
It's only recently I've been near the ocean.
It's really, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
You know what's funny? My animals are getting really active now that you're talking about the dolphins.
Yeah.
If you can hear my cat.
Everybody,
you know, my cat
dolphins
and dog are very, they're participants in this show.
Yeah.
And the ravens are cawing outside the window, too. It's like all of a sudden I have this awareness of the animals around. And I think something that your story conveys about the dolphins, and it's once again back to this respect thing, too, is that,
yeah,
you know, if we respect and are open to the possibilities about the animals around us, and I think this includes cats and dogs and all kinds of
absolutely
animals.
Yeah, it's very, very, it's very important. I
yeah
actually, for my retreat, I send everybody an email on dolphin etiquette.
Yes,
because
yes,
if they're, and not everyone has to swim with dolphins. That's not part of my retreat. You know, as a, you know, it's not mandatory or anything. It's an optional activity. There's three yoga classes a day, and then in between the classes, we can go out and swim with the dolphins if they happen to be there. And it's, you know, you never know when they're going to show up because they have their own, you know, they're on their own timing. But it's definitely, you know, one of the things that I really stress is that is that element of respect, and that they are a sovereign being. You know, they're a free being, and they're most likely to respond when you do have that attitude of respect. I think when people go and chase the dolphins, they just leave. They don't really appreciate being chased. So
yeah.
Yeah.
Well, somebody told me that I'm not. They said, "Don't you ever watch The Cove?" This person
I've heard that too, and
said it was so upsetting that, you know, actually recommended that I not watch it. And I have avoided it actually. Although sometimes I think, you know, being aware of what's going on again,
yeah,
you know, you're sitting with what's going
on in the world.
I'm
totally in love with the dolphins,
but I think I'd have a hard time watching that.
Yeah.
You know, I think children love dolphins. I remember being attracted to dolphins, even though I was living in a landlocked place. I never saw them, but when we would study them in school, I remember being particularly attracted to them. I mean, they're so intelligent, and dolphins and whales, we have no idea what they're capable of, and I think we only have hints of what they're capable of.
Yeah, they're extraordinary beings, really. They're just, I mean, it's beyond words, really. It's just, it's something to experience. If anybody ever has the chance once in their life, even if you're sitting on a boat, like a lot of days in the Hawaii, there's some people who weren't comfortable being in the water. We would just take a kayak out into the bay when they were in the bay, and they just seem to really like people. So, you know, you can just sit there in a kayak and sunbathe and have them come up to the side of the boat, but It is quite a remarkable experience. It's like nothing else.
Yeah.
It's very amazing.
Well, we're running out of time, and I want to thank you so much for being here, and also I want to give you the opportunity to tell people where they can find more out about your work and any upcoming events that you have, and also where you practice exactly, because you know Canada better than I do, so where your normal practice is. So if you just take a minute to let us know about that.
About where is a good place to do yoga?
Where's your website if people want to learn more about you and the events, and just tell us a little bit about that, because we're winding down.
Okay. My blog is probably the best one for information, which is innerlightyoga.blogspot.com. I do have another sort of main website, which is journeytolight.net, but the blog site, so that's innerlightyoga.blogspot. That one has the, I've posted yoga poses, so if you go onto the body tab, you'll see a sort of a practice that you can do. And the mind, so it says body, mind, spirit at the top of the page, so the mind is more the meditative, so there's some audio meditations and just some writing sort of about meditation. And the spirit is poetry and some little bit more mystical writing. And then I have, like you read about The Void, so I have The Diary of the Mystic Yogi, which is I'm sharing my journey. So that's my personal story, my journal entries of the various experiences I've had with expanded consciousness and things like that. So that's under Diary of a Mystic Yogi on my blog. And if you click on retreats, you'll see about the dolphin yoga retreat.
Okay, great. Great. Well, thank you so much for being here today, Christine. I look forward to seeing where you go next. I mean, your journey is so interesting and all the different things you're involved in. So I really appreciate your being here today. And I appreciate everyone in the chat who was here with us today. And also welcome those of you listening in the archive. I know we get quite a few listeners in the archive, and we appreciate your energy too in this moment. So thank you for sharing this time with us. And the Frontier Beyond Fear show will return again next week at this time, 11 a.m. Pacific. So thanks again, everyone, and we will see you next time.